This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
The BBC.
Welcome to the BBC Music Magazine podcast. I'm Rebecca Franks, the magazine's managing editor, and with me in the studio today are editorial assistant Freya Parr and deputy editor Jeremy Pound.
Hello.
Hello. We've gathered around the microphones today to chat all about the latest goings-ons in the world of classical music, from what's making the news headlines to which recordings are at the top of our CD piles or playlists this month. And, of course, we'll be talking about our March issue, On Sale Now. But before anything else, how about a spot of music to start the podcast? So that was Poulenc's Chanson Française, performed by the BBC Singers, conducted by Sophie Genin. And that's a clip from our March cover CD, which comes free with your magazine. On to music news.
Music news.
It's been a busy month in the classical music world, and we've brought along just one news story each that's caught our eye. But you'll find plenty more in our March issue. First up, Jeremy, what news do you have to share with us today?
Right, well, I suspect this may be the first of several Beethoven revelations, or at least some sort of Beethoven-related news stories we get over the course of the year, because, of course, this year is the 250th anniversary year of his birth in 1770. Right, well, kicking things off this year, we've got this story that Beethoven might not have been quite as deaf as we like to imagine. Popular belief is that he started to go deaf in sort of end of the 18th century, and by about 1814, 1815, he was stone deaf. However, recent research has suggested that actually he might have still had some element of hearing right up as late as about 1824, which was the time of the premiere of his Ninth Symphony, and only 3 years before he actually died. So where this research has come from is actually from his conversation books. And now, these are quite hard to explain what they are, but as Beethoven's hearing deteriorated, his friends and acquaintances would, rather than trying to speak to him and him try and lip read, they would actually write things down in conversation books. And it's what's slightly odd is that he rarely replied to them by writing replies. So they're very one-sided conversations, and we still have a lot of these conversation books. So you see what he was being asked, but we never hear his reply. Now and then he did actually write a reply, but very infrequently. Now, in the past, these conversation books have only been available in German, and clearly they haven't actually been studied that closely, otherwise we'd know about this evidence. But now an academic from Kent State University in Ohio called Theodor Albrecht, who's a very notable Beethoven scholar, is translating all of them. And he says within them, there's little clues which suggest that Beethoven was hearing quite well into the 1820s, or not hearing quite well, but at least he had some element of hearing into the 1820s. Interestingly, in one of these conversation books, and this is actually a reply from Beethoven himself, so this is his own words, and this is in 1823, Beethoven apparently told another person who was also losing his hearing that baths and country air could improve many things. Just do not use mechanical devices too early. By abstaining from them, I have fairly preserved my left ear in this way, suggesting that as late as 1823, he still had something, in, you know, some sort of hearing in his left ear. And there's one or two other things here and there which suggest that as late as, I say, 1824, he could still hear a little bit. Previously, we mentioned in the magazine that in 1820, there was some sort of evidence that he was listening to his nephew Carl play the piano and commenting on it then, using an ear trumpet. So even before now, that sort of previous thought of him being completely deaf by about 1816 seems unlikely.
I thought this was totally fascinating for so many reasons. Mm. I mean, what you just said, that actually these haven't been studied that closely before.
And
I kind of assumed that we sort of know everything there is to know about Beethoven's life and the documentation, and that's really been gone into. So it's really fascinating now that new evidence is still coming out.
I wonder if it's because they are these one-sided conversations and people kind of almost dismiss them because they weren't by Beethoven himself. And they thought, well, they're not that interesting. And there's 12 volumes of these conversation books. And I think a lot of the material in them is extremely trivial. It seems like, oh, what would you like me to get from the shops today? Or have you chased up that bill from your publisher? Or this, that and the other. Really quite mundane stuff.
So it's a lot of work.
There's a lot of work in that, I think, to find
reward.
These tiny little clues. But yeah. When they do throw up clues, I think they're actually probably quite fascinating.
You're right, though, because there has been so much, how many books have been published about Beethoven and how much research has been done. It does seem mad that there's that massive catalogue of work that's never been looked into in that detail.
And also when it relates to something as well that's so kind of tied up with our whole idea of Beethoven and his deafness. And I think when we did that feature a couple of years ago that you mentioned, Jeremy, that Robin Wallace wrote, which is sort of about new research around Beethoven's deafness. And actually, even then, he was sort of exploring how we kind of like this idea of struggle in Beethoven. We like this idea of, you know, that his music was maybe difficult because he was not hearing it out sort of out loud. He was hearing it inside his head. There's so many kind of, we impose so much of our narrative from that fact. And actually, we're probably wrong.
What makes it so interesting, of course, is because there is this very famous document written in 1802, October 1802, called the Heiligenstadt Testament, which he wrote to his brother at the time. He never sent it, so it was only discovered after his death, where he outlined the utter torment of knowing that he was going deaf. So at that stage, we knew that he had quite a lot of hearing left, but he knew that he was going deaf. And then after that, the kind of the trail of just how deaf he was goes a little bit cold. It's all very anecdotal evidence. So we really are guessing, as you say. Mm. So things like this are actually quite interesting.
You're right, kind of building that portrait from the Heiligenstadt Testament to the Ninth Symphony premiere, when there's that kind of infamous story of him conducting without being able to hear. And you're right, the bit in between is kind of sort of a grey area, so it's fascinating to hear a bit more about it.
And you suspect an awful lot of it has been romanticised as well, don't you? This whole idea of this cut off from the outside world and, you know, this sort of...
Yeah, still producing works of genius.
And it is more convenient for the story that he might be completely deaf by about 1814, 1815, whereas, in fact, possibly wasn't true.
Yeah. Mm. So to round off Jeremy's story, let's hear some of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, which he may have heard more of in performance than we had previously thought. That was the Molto Vivace, which is the second movement from Beethoven's Symphony No. 9, performed by the Minnesota Orchestra, conducted by Osmo Wenzke, and that's on BIS Records. You can hear a lot of Beethoven this year on Radio 3, as he is in Composer of the Week, every other week is going to be dedicated to his life and music. And as you might have guessed, that's a handy segue into Freya's news story.
Sublime segue. So, Radio 3. Yes, they have absolutely smashed it this year. The recent figures have just been released for the listener ratings. And they've kind of announced their highest ratings since 2016. And they've seen a 16% increase from this time last year, which is the largest growth across any station in the BBC radio stations, which is, I mean, it's when you actually compare, Radio 1's dropped off quite a lot and the others have enjoyed like a little bit of growth. But actually, Radio 3 has skyrocketed in comparison. And classical music stations across the board have kind of seen these improved ratings. Scala, the new digital station that launched last year, and I think about March, had an 8% increase. Classic FM had 6%. And it's all kind of, they're showing a lot more significant growth than other talk-led radio stations, which is really interesting. And everyone's kind of made assumptions as to why that might be. Are we wanting to escape the news a bit more and listen to a bit more slow radio with birds chirping and discover classical music? So, yeah, it's an exciting time.
Yes, because my kind of Radio 3 listening, I have to say, is slightly dictated by work hours. Mm. I tend to be a sort of evening concert person. Mm. And also, if I'm working from home, I'll stick it on at home. So I'll kind of like the morning programmes, etc. Do we know which particular programmes have boosted the ratings?
I think Breakfast done well, hasn't it?
Breakfast did really well. Yeah, and the weekend one. Breakfast one with Elizabeth Elka, I think, did particularly well. That kind of had massive figures.
I have to say, and I'm not just saying this because we work for a BBC music magazine, but I think the Breakfast Show, it's a really brilliant way to start your day. And it's a really great selection of music they have there. And if you do, I made a decision not to start my day with the news and to start with music every day. And I feel so much happier for doing it, I have to say.
It was interesting. Recently in our immediate media big meeting with our publishers, they talked about whether we should have the news screens showing up news stories as people come into work in the morning. And I hadn't actually really considered it in much depth. And I, too, have started listening to Radio 3 as opposed to Radio 4 in the morning and moving on to Radio 4 later in the day. And I agree. It is just like a nicer way to sort of segue yourself into the day rather than being met with abrasive news.
I don't want to do too much Radio 3 tub thumping here. However, I have to say one of the loveliest things in life is coming home from work and sticking on the InTune mixtape, which is just half an hour.
It's such a great programme.
With no talking at all. It's brilliant.
Yeah. So I brought a news story about something completely different, which is that the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment has decided that for their next tour, which is to Poland and Hungary, they won't be travelling by plane, but that they're going to be taking the train instead. And that's part of a wider commitment to become carbon neutral. And the players have themselves voted to do this, even though it means that it's going to take them a lot longer, up to a day, I think, each way, rather than 2.5 hours by plane. And also, it's not great for their budget. I think it costs quite a lot more. But I did think that was an interesting bit of news. And I think we're going to be seeing more and more of this from ensembles.
I'm not convinced they're trying to compete or anything, but the Academy of Ancient Music, which is another period instrument ensemble, has also recently revealed that they are also aiming to become carbon neutral by their 50th birthday season, which is next year, I believe. And they're actually based in Cambridge, the Academy of Ancient Music, and they're consulting with lots of local scientists, because they have very good links with the university, about how they might do it and what plans they can take. And I presume that transport will form part of their plans as well.
I think it's great because it's finally orchestras and these bigger organisations are putting their money where their mouth is a little bit. And actually, music is such a global industry. And the amount of flights the conductors and the soloists must take year on year is astronomical. So it's great. It actually links in similarly to a story that we spoke about a while ago in the podcast about the Helsingborg Symphony Orchestra from Sweden, who actually banned conductors and soloists travelling by plane at all because they're very much on the sustainability drive. And actually, it's good to finally see them all kind of joining forces and moving in the right direction.
It's a great excuse for getting rid of a conductor, isn't it? Sorry, you can't come.
You're not willing.
We want to go green. No conductor needed. Do without you.
When I visited the Gothenburg Opera House, they were in the throes of preparation for their Wagner Ring cycle, which everything was going to be recycled, which meant everything with the sets and the costumes. And I mean, a lot of the stuff in the opera house is already, they're very into sustainability and trying to make everything as green as possible. But there was an example of where it's actually even affecting the aesthetic of the production, which I thought was very interesting too.
Given that half these period instrument ensembles are kind of into replicating what it was like when the original music was written, surely they'd all want to turn up by kind of horse and cart rather than train.
Well, I think that would be the only authentic thing to do.
Yeah, I think really so. It's a bit of a halfway house going by train, isn't it? They're still opting
cheating.
Out.
Cheating. We should be candlelight. And
it should be candlelight as well. Exactly.
Right, well, that brings us to the end of the news section, so we'll go on to this month's magazine.
This month's magazine.
Well, before we actually get into talking about the magazine, just a quick plug for a few other ways you can engage with BBC Music Magazine. Don't forget our website at classical-music.com, where you can read all about the latest music happenings, read thousands of reviews and a good deal more. Plus, we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and we have an iPad edition available on the App Store. And if you fancy subscribing to our print edition, we have a special discount for our wonderful podcast listeners. All of you can now get 30% off every 6 issues, which takes the cost to just £25.15. You can claim the offer by visiting buysubscriptions.com/musicpodcast. Jeremy, can you tell us about the March issue cover?
Right. I'm going to ask you a little question.
Oh, dear.
Okay. Three famous opera singers. If you asked the general public to name three famous opera singers from all time, which three would you think they'd say?
Pavarotti, Callas, yeah. And Caruso. Yeah.
I think so. Agreed. As well. I think those are the three. They're strange. Although kind of people are aware of the likes of kind of Brinter, Fell, Placido, Domingo, etc., I think widespread there are those just three names who are sort of household names. However, loads of people know the name Caruso. They go, ah, yes, Enrico Caruso. But how many people actually know that much about him? I'll be honest, I didn't actually know a huge amount about him until I read this month's cover feature.
Yes, nicely done.
On the front cover of the March issue, we have got Enrico Caruso looking absolutely magnificent in
I love this cover.
His big tash and his outfit.
Flamboyant hat.
Very flamboyant outfit. And we've done it. We've taken a fairly simple approach that we've looked at with the headline on the magazine just simply says The Great Caruso. And what we have done is looked at his life and asked, why was he great? What did he do which kind of made him stand out? He came from fairly kind of humble stock, but went on to become the great great recording figure of his age. He recorded very prolifically. He went from Naples opera houses to perform right across the world, and really made a lot of kind of roles his own, particularly Puccini in the sort of late 19th century, early 20th Italian repertoire was really his thing. And it's just a look at his story and how he actually had a comparatively short life. But in our piece, George Hall looks at what he achieved in that short life and how he kind of set the standard for future opera singers to come.
Mm. And he was so kind of tied up as well, wasn't he, with the advent of recording,
yes.
Which also makes him such an interest. Maybe it was part of the success as well and his reputation. And there's that wonderful anecdote about when he's recording these 10 songs and what fee would he accept? And he said he wanted £100, which is about £8,000 in today's money. And the agent wanted approval, got the reply, fee exorbitant, forbid you to record. And they went ahead and did it anyway. And it was a bestseller.
Do you know something? It always helps to be in the right place in the right time in history, because just as Caruso was there at the kind of the dawn of the recording age, so his was the voice that everyone heard and wanted to hear, kind of fast forward many decades and you get to the advent of the CD, which is what partly launched the huge success of the three tenors. And so it kind of repeats itself. When there's a new format, there's a whole new market waiting to be captured.
And he had his global reach was kind of greater than probably anyone since, really, in the kind of scope that he had. And I actually came across him in more detail through another podcast called the Switched On Pop podcast, which is about pop music. And they kind of did like a little look back as to how classical and pop had kind of crossed over in history. And they were kind of singing his praises and looking at the massive appeal he had kind of across record. Like, no one buys records now like they did then. Mm. And he was just in every home and he was kind of... the popularity of One Direction combined with
it reminds me of Brindirville. Alexandra Wilson wrote that piece for us about opera stars in their heyday, and they were the big celebrities before, you know, the big Hollywood film era. Yeah. So that was that kind of period where they were just the huge names in the same way that film stars perhaps are for us today. And he kind of falls right into that.
I mean, to be fair, and it wasn't just his sort of persona, his voice, when you actually do take the chance to listen to it, he has wonderful agility, sort of.
Yeah.
I don't know how better to describe it, but there's this beautiful sound, and it always sounds effortless. Yeah. Never, even the kind of most testing repertoire, he never really sounds as though he's pained at all. He's actually so, so easy.
Yeah, just that like, real direct connection with the audience in a way, just like speaking to you.
And there's something quite interesting when you listen to his recordings out. I know a couple of years ago they put his voice with like a modern orchestra in a modern recording context, and it didn't have quite the same effect because it was, obviously he's got such an incredible voice that cuts over the top, but actually there's something really magical about, you can hear like the dawn of the recording era and the kind of early wax cylinder technology being used. Pretty great combination.
Well, it's like those recordings of Menuhin when he was very young, recording violin concertos, particularly the Mendelssohn violin concerto. Mm. It's got a real atmosphere of it, partly because of the recording at the time. I don't know. It's
very or Arthur Schnabel with his Beethoven.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. I know some people.
Yeah.
Some people don't because of that, but yeah. Great. Okay. Well, should we move on now to our composer of the month? So that was the Vivo from Basevich's String Quartet No. 3. That was played by the Lutoslawski Quartet, and it's a Naxos recording. So, as you may have guessed, our composer of the month is Grażyna Basevich, who is one of Poland's most brilliant composers. And we've got a lovely feature by John Allison, who's painted a really great portrait of her. She lived from 1909 to 1969. Well, Lutoslawski described her as a natural-born true musician, combining, like the great masters of the Baroque, the talent of a creator and a performer into one harmonious whole. And she was indeed a violinist and a pianist, as well as a composer. String instruments are very sort of prominent in her music, and she wrote these wonderful string quartets, seven of them, as well as, I think it was 11 concertos, many of which are for the violin. And she's a really wonderful composer. And even though she's probably never really been completely out of the spotlight in her life, I think she's now really sort of taking her place on the international stage, and especially in recordings. There have been some really great ones on Shandos and Naxos recently. And I think if you like, you know, Shostakovich, Prokofiev, Martinu, Janacek, yeah, well, it's sort of neoclassical era. You'd definitely be interested in her music. So it goes through all these different phases as well. Is the neoclassical? Later, she went into kind of serial music. This is sort of the Soviet kind of feel to it. So it's kind of great variety. Yeah, and it's a really lovely piece about her.
What is quite interesting, I found, because when with these Composer of the Month pieces, which we put in the magazine, inevitably it takes a little bit of research on our part. To do the kind of accompanying material, such as the Life and Times box and various other box outs. Normally with 20th century composers, it's very easy to find things to write about them. With her, it was surprisingly difficult. There's very little information about her to be found, either about her life and her times, or actually about her music in general. You're told about her competition wins. She was a serial competition winner.
Yeah.
But that's actually fairly dull to read about that she won this competition. But actually about, and we know that she had a serious car crash.
Yeah.
Which basically meant she gave up her piano and her violin career and concentrated on composing. But beyond that, it's very hard to find actually that much about her. So she obviously had quite a sort of, I don't know, secretive life, I wouldn't say necessarily, but because of where she was at the time, there's not an awful lot of information kicking around about her now.
But there were other things as well that, you know, that just, she's very prolific, and she obviously had this huge energy because she wrote novels as well and that were actually published and plays. You know, that's just as an aside to her, you know, properly professional career as a prize-winning pianist, violinist,
an overachiever,
an overachiever.
But it's quite hard to gauge what she was like from the information, what she was like as a person, isn't it?
Yes, I'd agree.
Because normally, kind of with the likes of Prokofiev and Shostakovich, contemporaries such as that, you really know what they were like as people because they were so well documented. Whereas here, you really are kind of clutching at straws, trying to find things.
I think there were lots of sort of interesting elements that I was kind of tantalised by in a way. Even her name, Grażyna, was an invention of Adam Mickiewicz, who was sort of Poland's sort of national writer in a way. And it's about a mythical Lithuanian female warrior. And that was interesting because Lithuania and Poland, her family ended up being split between them in this kind of shared heritage. So, and there were lots of kind of interesting moments that I'd even like to know even more about, actually.
Yeah, you're right. In the last couple of years, potentially, there's been quite a lot more recording done of her work, quite significantly, like noticeably, actually, because there was a bit of an absence before that. So you wonder if more about her will come out in the next... If we're still finding out about Beethoven.
Well, maybe it's in Polish. Maybe there's stuff that hasn't been translated into English.
Yeah. Exactly.
Talking about translation, how important that is. For...
Just hasn't travelled the information yet.
Mm. Yeah.
Agreed.
Freya,
yes.
Which article have you brought to talk about?
So this month we spoke to Sofia Gabaidelina, the composer, in conjunction with the fact that she's just won the very prestigious Royal Philharmonic Society's gold medal, and she's the first female composer to do so. So we sent Daniel Jaffe to meet Sofia to kind of talk about her growing up in the USSR and how she kind of pushed against the regime. It was absolutely fascinating. It was quite a historical look back at the kind of the political time that she grew up in, because it's such an interesting time that, and looking at how she kind of experimented with sound as a child and how it kind of continued on into her very avant-garde compositional style. There's so much to explore with her as a composer. I think I'm only really scratching the surface recently, but I actually came across her work for accordion yesterday in one of my brief notes discs called De Profundis, which... it absolutely blew me away. It was kind of, it's dark and eerie and really abrasive, but very virtuosic and actually really beautiful. And her compositions are just incredible. And I think there's so much to discover with her and looking back on her fascinating upbringing and kind of working within the USSR and how she kind of smuggled her violin concerto out of the USSR to get premiered by Gidon Kremer. There's just like brilliant little anecdotes peppered throughout.
And I love the little connection to Beethoven. She talks about... when she was awarded the RPS gold medal, it was especially important to her because it's from the Royal Philharmonic Society, which was so bound up with commissioning Beethoven Symphony number 9. And she says, you know, she thinks for the sake of the serious development of humanity, the pursuit of composing profound classical music is most important, more important than poetry, literature, or any occupation in the sphere of technology and science. So she's got this incredible belief in the power of music, and she kind of relates that to Beethoven. And I found that very inspiring, actually, as well.
She's very philosophical. The quotes that are kind of throughout the piece, I had to kind of reread some of them again and again because there's so much to kind of unwrap with the... she's such a brilliant brain. So, yes. So now let's listen to a little bit of Gabaidelina's work. This is the Chaconne, played by pianist Anna Vinitskaya on the Ambrosie label.
Also in the March issue, we have an interview with the pianist Noriko Ogawa. Richard Brattby takes us behind the scenes of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra in its centenary year. Jessica Dushan interviews John Wilson, the conductor who has newly reformed the Symphonia of London. In our Building a Library, we're looking at Debussy's Prelude for piano. And there are also all of our regular features, including the Music That Changed Me interview, Richard Morrison's column, and all of the regular features. Now let's move on to First Listen. First Listen. Before we kick off with sharing our favourite new recordings, we'd like to tell you about how you can get involved in sharing your musical discoveries with us and fellow readers. You can send us what you've been listening to at music@classical-music.com, and you could be in with a chance of being published on our Music to My Ears page in the magazine. And you can also head to our listening room on Facebook, where you can chat about all your musical discoveries there with fellow readers. So for my first listen, I have actually been enjoying two discs that showcase the Boulanger sisters, Lily and Nadia. One is with the tenor Cyril Dubois, and that's actually literally just arrived on my desk this morning, so I've just started to dip into listening to that. The second is from tenor Nicolas Fan, and he has built a programme around Lily Boulanger's song cycle, Clairière dans le ciel, which was written in 1913. Brace yourself for some cheery stuff here. It's all about love and, well, loss of love. It's a man sort of reminiscing on this relationship with a woman, and it all goes a bit sour. And we're going to hear a clip from the devastating final song, which is called Demain fera un an, which is tomorrow it will be a year. And it ends with the words, nothing left. I have nothing left. Nothing left to hold me up. And that disc is on the Avi label. Jeremy, what have you brought along?
Well, thanks for that very cheery start there,
You're
Rebecca.
Welcome, you're welcome.
Plunge us into despair. Thankfully, I've got something a little bit chirpier. What I've been listening to recently is 33 Miniatures for Piano by Gia Cancelli. We've had a bit of a 20th century Eastern Bloc theme to our podcast this month, and I'm going to continue this here. For those who don't know Cancelli, he was Georgian. He died fairly recently, actually, only last year. Very kind of influential composer in Georgia and beyond. Now then, his 33 miniatures here, which are performed by George Vachnadze on the piano, and this is on the Piano Classics label. They are all between about 1 minute and 3 minutes long, these pieces, and actually all based on music which Cancelli wrote for either plays or film. He was actually a very prolific film composer. It's a quirky listen, and the character of the music, because as you'd expect for film music, because he kind of adapted his style to fit, it moves from sort of, there's a couple which have a real Satie-like stillness, there's a couple of very jazzy sort of Gershwin-y type ones, there's some very lyrical stuff, which reminded me almost like sort of kind of Chopin or something like that. It's a real mix of styles. The one I'm going to choose, you tell me what you think it sounds like. It's quite funny. It almost sounds like a kind of a children's piece. And it's called Extraordinary Exhibition, which was actually a film by Eldar Shengalaya in 1969. So it's music from that, or it's derived from music which he wrote from that. Now, I just have to kind of say that trying to pick one track from this album is very difficult, because the whole charm of the album lies in the fact that it changes mood so much and you kind of plunge from one area to the other. So that's just one little bit of it, but it's not all like
very
that.
Very jaunty.
It was a nice pick-me-up,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Exactly.
After yours.
Yeah, very jaunty. Just really needed a little moment in your day where...
Exactly.
Freya, what have you brought for us to listen to?
So I am continuing the theme of the kind of Eastern Europe spirit this podcast. So I'm bringing a collection of works by the Lithuanian composer, whose name is very difficult to pronounce, and I've done a lot of research and I'm unsure I'm going to get it right. Raminta Shcherbina. Everyone can judge me accordingly for that. And she's a kind of rising star Lithuanian composer, and her works here are performed by the Lithuanian National Symphony Orchestra under Mirga Grzyńska-Tyla. And it's just another instance of Mirga kind of championing a lesser-known composer from this fascinating musical country, really. There's so much being produced over there. That's actually, it's great that it's been given a platform over here now. And it's kind of, the whole disc is quite spacious and mythical with a whole mix of influences. It kind of explores Indian raga-type improvisations with these Baltic sound worlds. And it's quite cinematic. You can imagine it sort of working quite well in a score, and it kind of takes you through the day as well. It explores a lot to do with nature. So there's the final kind of piece on the disc is called Songs of Sunset and Dawn, which is, I think, is particularly magical, and it kind of follows the process of the natural world waking up and kind of travelling throughout the day. And the natural world is kind of at the centre of quite a few of the pieces on this disc. And it utilises all the forces of the orchestra. So it's quite difficult to find a clip of a good length from this disc, because it's such a spacious disc that it kind of gradually unfurls over quite a long time frame. But we're going to listen to an extract from the third movement of Songs of Sunset and Dawn, which is called Morning, Eternal Morning. Songs of Sunset and Dawn, taken from the recent DG disc of works by Raminta Shirkshnita.
Thank you very much. And that brings us to the end of this month's podcast. Our jingles, each one inspired by a different English choral composer, were written by Christopher Maxim. And our podcast is produced here in Bristol by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. So it's goodbye from me, Freya and Jeremy, and there'll be another group of the BBC Music Magazine team to chat next month about our April issue. See you then. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
The BBC Music Magazine Podcast.